Welcome to Heart with Anna, featuring your host, Anna Jaworski. Our program is a program designed to empower the CHD, or congenital heart defect, community. Our program may also help families who have children who are chronically ill by bringing information and encouragement to you in order to become an advocate for your community. Now, here is Anna Jaworski.
Welcome to Heart with Anna. I am Anna Jaworski and the host of this radio program. This is the fourth episode of Season 7 of Heart to Heart with Anna. Our theme this season is congenital heart defects around the globe. I'm very excited for today's show to feature a heart dad in Israel. I've known Michael Lieben for almost 20 years, but this is the first time for us to actually talk to one another. Most of our communication has been over the internet because we belong to some of the same heart groups. We used to belong to a group called PD Heart, and that was 18 years ago. It's just hard to believe we're finally having a show together. I'm really, really excited. Michael is the father of Liel Lieben. Liel was born with double outlet right ventricle, or DORV, and a ventricular septal defect, or VSD. In her life, she had a pulmonary artery banding, a Restelli, a conduit later replaced with a Contigra conduit, for a total of 3 heart surgeries and 4 heart caths. At age 4, Liel was diagnosed with autism, and then at age 13 with epilepsy. Liel was a stunningly happy child who loved music and creative activities. She was happy every day of her life, and the only thing she totally hated was epilepsy and the total lack of control that engendered. At age 13 and a half, she had gone to live in a home with other autistic children, many of whom also had epilepsy, so they were not surprised when she developed it. Nobody, however, expected that one morning it would simply take her without warning. However, Liel would not have gotten as far as she did if it wasn't for all the help and support she received from doctors, donors, and the Israeli health system. Michael is a filmmaker. For about 18 years, he taught in both high school and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He taught television production and filmmaking. Michael and his wife, Leora, have been married for 28 years, and they also have 2 other children, Idan and Sapir, who were wonderful siblings to Liel. So welcome to Heart with Anna, Michael.
Well, thanks for having me. This is really exciting to finally hear your voice.
It is exciting. I'm so happy that you're talking to us all the way from Israel. And I guess the first thing I have to do is to express my condolences, because when I knew you or met you 18 years ago, Liel was a baby and you were telling us and sharing with us all the different things that she was going through. And I don't think we've really talked a whole lot since you lost Liel.
No, we haven't actually. I've been out of touch with the community. I still get all the PD Heart connections, but I'm very out of touch with most of them now.
Well, I'm glad that you're in touch with me today and that we can talk about the healthcare system in Israel. I don't know anything about it, so why don't you start by telling us a little bit about Liel and her surgeries and how all of that took place in Israel?
Well, that's a very long and complicated story. Essentially, the health system is socialized medicine, but everybody here has to have coverage, and there are different competing private companies. And so you choose the company that you want, and they all have to give the same basic service. And then each company can offer additional services for more money. So we all have the basic pay, and then we can get as much as we want. And it's not that expensive. It's quite doable. One of the best things, I think, that for Liel in her life was that she was born here, that she had really great health coverage, and that despite all of the things that she was born with, there was no problem with anything, any pre-existing condition. In fact, it often gave her a pass. So, for example, if you had to pay like $1.50 to see a doctor and maybe $5 to see a specialist, she paid $1.50 to see the specialist because she had pre-existing conditions and because she needed extra help. It's counterintuitive to what you think insurance company would do. And she got breaks and she got better prices. And all along, the surgery was always there. The finest hospitals were always there. And to her great benefit, everything she needed, she had. And it didn't break us. So it was really a lot simpler than you would think.
It really is. I don't think I've ever heard of any surgeons or hospitals in Israel doing open heart surgery. And she had the Restelli. So that is not a simple operation. That's a fairly complicated operation. So where did she have her surgeries? And it sounds like you all have state-of-the-art facilities there.
We do. And one of the good things is her first cardiologist was a guy who, had, among other places, had studied and spent some time at Boston Children's. So he really is the children's cardiologist of children's cardiologist. He really was the top one. And at the time, it was a smaller community of families. And so he was actually everybody's doctor, even though there were other doctors at the same hospital. It all sort of funneled through him. Now it's a bit larger. At the time, also, there were two hospitals that were doing surgery for pediatric cardiology, Hadassah Hospital, across town from where I live, and another hospital in Petah Tikva, which is a city near Tel Aviv. So the coverage was really very good, and it was a toss-up as to which of the hospitals were better. They're actually both excellent. Today in Jerusalem, there's at least one more hospital that I know of that's doing it for pediatric cardiology. Hadassah Hospital, where we were for many years, now has opened up a new unit for adults with CHD so that you don't have to leave the hospital. You just move from one department to another department when you're 18. It's getting better. It's getting more widespread. And some of the best surgeons are really right here. It's amazing, actually. We're very lucky.
You are really lucky. And that's so good to know. I wanted the listeners of the radio show from all over the world to know what kind of resources were available. And so now we know that there are some state-of-the-art programs right there, not only for children with congenital heart defects, but even for the adults that they grow into. And it's a joy, Michael, to see so many of our early survivors making it. That's what makes it so heartbreaking for me to talk to you about Liel, because she didn't make it. But it doesn't sound like it was her heart that caused her demise. It sounds like
that's
the epilepsy.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. Her heart was actually fine. She had a pacemaker, and the pacemaker was working fine, but she had a very serious epileptic seizure, and she didn't breathe. So I asked about that, because if the pacemaker is working, what's the problem? They said, well, the heart can beat, but if there's no oxygen coming in from the lungs, there's a spasm, then it's just running on empty. And that's what happened. So the heart was fine, and the pacemaker was fine, and the part that scared everybody about where she lived was not eventually what took her. And that's just the way it breaks. You don't know tomorrow if we're going to get up or not. And it's just the way it was. Not a lot of people in the epilepsy community are aware. There's a thing called SUDEP, S-U-D-E-P, Sudden Unexpected Death in Epilepsy. Of course, the morning it started, I called my pediatrician, and she recognized it right away. And I think essentially what they did was it started on a Friday morning at about 5:45. And they brought in the paramedics, and they actually stopped the process. She was probably dying right there, and they stopped it. And they got her to the hospital with a low blood pressure, but some blood pressure, and a low heartbeat, but some heartbeat. And they held on to her for a few days while the rest of it slowly went down. And my feeling is that really she was having sudden unexpected death, and they just found a way to drag it out all the way till, I think it was Sunday or Monday night. So these are the things that happen, and this is what life is about, and sometimes things go south, and there's really nothing to do about it.
I think that's one of the things that draws us heart parents so close, don't you think, Michael? Because we all know that any day could be the last with our children.
Well, that's absolutely right, because I remember thinking, when she was much younger, that we're actually living under that specter every single day, and we spend a lot of time worried about the heart. And that's the part that hurts so much, because we were so fixated on the heart for a long, long time. And then after autism came on, which was much more visible and apparent, we were fixated on autism. When this came, we were totally surprised and caught completely off guard. But it's the sort of thing that we know about every day. I mean, I guess if you think about it, the specter is there for everybody, but we just are so much more aware of our children and children with heart defects that I don't want to say I wasn't surprised. I was totally shocked. I'm just saying that we sort of every day we know this could be it. Something else I want to say about that, because a lot of people told me that the first reaction is when you lose a child is everybody tells you it's wrong because a child should outlive a parent. But you know what? That's not necessarily true. It's only true in the last maybe 50, 60, 100 years since we've been curing diseases left and right, right? Why do people in the Middle East tend to have 10, 12 children? Because this is a part of the world where polio vaccines didn't come as early as they came to other places, and vaccines and other things that and other cures to diseases didn't come as early. And why traditionally people here have so many children? So that a few will survive. My mother-in-law was born in Yemen, and she is one of 9 brothers and sisters. But her mother gave birth, or nearly gave birth, 18 times.
Wow.
Okay? So if you think about it, ours is the spoiled generation. We expect our children to outlive us. And that's not necessarily correct in terms of just the way people live. So we have to be very, very thankful for what we have, because we don't always realize we take for granted our children and that they're going to outlive us. Not
You're
at
right.
all, for sure.
Not You're right. Sure. That's absolutely true. And you're right. 100 years ago, that wasn't even the case in the United States.
Of course
so
not.
So you're right. That is a huge change. And you're right. There are so many families that did have many, many children because so many of them didn't survive the first year. And that's kind of a sad note for us to go to commercial, but let's take a real quick commercial break. But don't leave yet, listeners, because when we come back, we're going to talk to Michael about how Liel was diagnosed with autism and what services are available for children with autism in Israel and advice that he would have for other Israeli parents of children with autism. We come back after this brief commercial break.
Anna Jaworski has written several books to empower the congenital heart defect, or CHD, community. These books can be found at Amazon.com or at her website, www.babyheartspress.com. Her bestseller is The Heart of a Mother, an anthology of stories written by women for women in the CHD community. Anna's other books, My Brother Needs an Operation, The Heart of a Father, and Hypoplastic Left Heart Syndrome, a handbook for parents, will help you understand that you are not alone. Visit babyheartspress.com to find out more.
Welcome back to our show, Heart to Heart with Anna, a show for the congenital heart defect community. Today's show is Hearts Around the Globe, Israel, and we're talking with Michael Lieben. Michael is a bereaved father to Liel, and Liel was born with complex congenital heart defects that required multiple open heart surgeries and catheterizations. She was also eventually diagnosed with both autism and epilepsy. So Michael, it seems to me that here in the United States, we keep hearing the word autism a lot more than we ever did 20 years ago. And you said that Liel was diagnosed with autism. So can you tell me when she received the diagnosis and what that meant to your family?
Sure. The official diagnosis, I think she was already 4. But by then we had sort of been aware of it. She was already in special ed because she had physical issues, muscle tone and that sort of thing. But the school noticed that she was showing some other difficulties. And I questioned if maybe she was hard of hearing because sometimes we'd call her and she'd be disinterested and she wouldn't come and look at us or anything like that. And as it turns out, she actually was deaf in one ear, but they picked up that there were some communications issues. We added a communications expert to be with her in class and to help her. And then we got the official diagnosis. And I think that was pretty massive for us because we had been concentrated on physically keeping her alive for so long. So we were concentrated very much on the heart issues, and then there were hearing issues and sight issues and other things. But one thing I think we feared was just nothing like that, not autism. We, of course, didn't know the difference between autism or other difficulties, other mental difficulties. We didn't know the difference between anything. What do you know? And just not that. I remember also typing in the group, I said, just not the A word. So that, of course, is what we got. And it's devastating because now you're completely in unknown territory. There's no doctor that tells you what to do. Everybody with autism is different. So she's not on anybody's radar because things that you wouldn't expect she's really good at. And she's good at math and she likes to be around people. But then other things she's completely not good at socially and every other way. So we had to go out and pretty much invent the wheel. That was really hard on the other kids too, because suddenly now we needed more help. So we had to grow the kids up and make them adults much, much faster than they were. Well, so she was 4, Sweden was 7, and Sapir was 6. And suddenly we needed kids to be home at 4 o'clock to help with Liel when she came off the bus. We needed kids to be home to help with Liel just to get things straightened around the house. The older Liel got, the more difficult it was for me to take care of her, whatever personal needs she needed. So we needed Sapir. We needed another girl around the house to do things. And the result is my kids sacrificed a portion of their childhood, but became responsible adults when they were 9, wow. Which is a good trade-off, but it's still a trade-off and something that I feel really bad about and will always feel bad about, having deprived them. On the other hand, today as adults, they're stunningly wonderful people.
I think that our children are given certain challenges, just like we are as adults, and that helps to define who they really will become.
Absolutely. Sapir today is running a small business on the internet. She's living with her boyfriend. She's 20 years old, and she's acting like she's 35. And well, it's true. And she can do it, A, because when she was a kid, all girls like to pretend to be adults, and they move their hands and sit that way like they're all grown up. But she means it. She's not faking it. This kid is 35, and she's... But in a good way. I mean, she's a totally wonderful adult human being and completely at age 20 out of my hands and out of everything. She's just another great person that I know. And it's hard to think of her as my child because she's not a child anymore.
Right. I have 2 adult children too, Michael, so I can totally relate. What kind of services were available to help Liel after she was diagnosed with the autism? Like you said, there wasn't a doctor saying, here's what you do now. But you said she was already in special ed. Did they have special services for autism in the public school system?
They did, and it's wonderful. One of the reasons is a certain government minister, whose name I probably shouldn't mention at the time, one of his children was diagnosed to be on the spectrum. Very high functioning, went to a school down the block from here. But because he needed help, the city of Jerusalem got really, really good at giving that kind of help. And we were very lucky to have that. What they do is, at the time there were 8, now I think there's more like 12 or 15 classes of communications issues, various points on the spectrum of autism. And the classes are in public schools, spread out around the city. So together it's one big school, but the school itself is spread out all over town. Now that is good because geographically kids don't have to travel that far. The classes are also made of kids of similar abilities, and it's all very specifically worked out per child. So it's wonderful. The educators are really well trained. There's a tremendous amount of adults around the room. At one point, Liel had a shadow who actually sat with her and worked with her in class. It's really very good. The educational programming for kids with autism is just great. School is out in late June, and they stay in. They call it camp. They stay in until almost the last week of August. They're out, they get like a one-week vacation, and they go right back to school. Whenever there's a school vacation for a long holiday, they have camp. They go to school anyway. When there were teacher strikes, special ed stayed in. So they got all the benefits of striking and everything they needed, but the kids didn't suffer, and the parents of the kids didn't suffer because there was a strike. This is Israel. We know how to strike well. So as far as I remember, for public education, there's no extra charge. It's just regular public school. And the bus picks her up and the bus brings her back. There were additional services that we did pay for. We found an afternoon program. A religious organization ran an afternoon program for kids with all kinds of difficulties and challenges. And they would pick her up from school a couple of times a week and then bring her home. And that cost money, but it was very, very affordable. It's all graded by how much you earn. And they don't want you to be hurt. They want you to have the assistance that you need. And that's how it's always been. So it's always been like that.
That's really amazing. Well, what is the best advice then that you can offer Israeli parents whose children have been diagnosed with autism, or maybe the children haven't been diagnosed yet, but the parents feel something's wrong?
First of all, there's a very good organization here for families with autistic children. They fight the political fight. They get services that we need. Don't ever be alone. You don't have to be. You don't have to invent the wheel. Thousands of families have already invented it for you. The best advice is get into a group, get into any kind of organization, locally or otherwise. Make sure your kid is on the way to the right school and with a diagnosis, and speak to other families. Don't be afraid. You are not alone. You should never have to be alone. And it's always somebody who's been there. And as I said, although every kid is completely different, the families go through the same twisting and the same torments and the same working it out like everybody else. Talk to people, take the advice. It's okay to listen. A lot of people don't like to do that, and they should. Really, the best thing is just get into groups and be with people.
Would you be willing to share the name with us of the organization that you said is so good?
Absolutely. It's called ALUT, A-L-U-T. I'm sure it's an acronym, and I don't remember what it is, but ALUT works to provide money for education. They get the schools going. They have meetings with parents. They have group sessions and group therapies. They are just fantastic. This private organization that we sent her to for the afternoon, every now and then, they would take her for a weekend, take her on a trip, give us a weekend to just relax and normalize at home with everybody else. These are great organizations. ALUT has spent a lot of time and a lot of energy in the world of politics and in parliament. They've been pushing for services for autistic kids, and they're getting it. Because as you said before, we're hearing that word a lot more than ever before. And it's not necessarily that there's more autistic kids than there ever were, but it's reported much more.
Right.
And it's out of the shadows. And people were scared. In more traditional communities, you don't want to tell people that you have a child with a disease or a difficulty because it might affect your other children getting married. And that's a real issue for a lot of religious families. And there are a lot of religious families here. So it was in the shadows for a very long time. It's coming out. It's okay. People are aware. People talk. Some of the best organizations I've seen for any kids with any difficulties are the religious organizations. They bring it out. They bring it to the front. And they don't let you be alone, which is the most important thing. Because as alone as autistic kid looks because he or she is sort of locked away somewhere, that family is locked away right with her. We're just as closed off from our friends and neighbors as she is because suddenly there's a bubble around us. You can break that bubble. You don't have to be alone.
I love that. Let's break the bubble. Well, let's take a quick commercial break. Don't leave yet, because coming up next, we're going to talk to Michael about what he's learned about epilepsy after his daughter received that diagnosis and what help is available for children with epilepsy in Israel. We'll be right back after this quick commercial break.
Anna Jaworski has spoken around the world at congenital heart defect events, and she is available as a keynote or guest speaker for your event. Go to hearttoheartwithanna.com to learn more about booking Anna for your event. You can also find out more about the radio program, keep up to date with CHD resources and information about advocacy groups, as well as read Anna's weekly blog. Anna wants you to stay well connected and participate in the CHD community. Visit hearttoheartwithanna.com today.
Welcome back to our show, Heart to Heart with Anna, a show for the congenital heart defect community. Today's show is Hearts Around the Globe, Israel, and we are talking with Michael Lieben. Michael is the bereaved father to Liel, and she was born with complex congenital heart defects that required multiple open heart surgeries and even a pacemaker, but that's not what took her. What ended up taking her was epilepsy, and she was diagnosed with both autism and epilepsy. We just finished talking about her autism diagnosis, so Michael, let's talk about this epilepsy. She was diagnosed much later in life with epilepsy, and it sounds like that was just a horrible thing for you and your family to have to deal with. So why don't you tell us what happened, what transpired that brought you all to that new diagnosis?
Well, it started one morning. She was 13 and she apparently had a seizure, and none of us had ever seen it before. So there was some panic. We called an ambulance. By the time they came, she was over it. Most seizures are very short. They're less than a minute, maybe 2-3 minutes, maybe half a minute. And I didn't see a lot of it because I was running around trying to get the ambulance. But she had a seizure. And then, of course, we had to do an EEG, which is kind of funny. You have to do an EEG if there's been a seizure, but if there isn't a seizure going on during the EEG, it will never find it anyway. And we needed it anyway because she was about to move up north to that home for autistic kids where she was going to live. So we needed an EEG anyway as part of the application process. So that was fine. And they said to us, they said, don't worry about it. A lot of times a kid will have a seizure and then it's over and doesn't come back. And that's the end of it. And it seemed that way for about a year. And then she suddenly started having a lot of seizures while she was up there in the home. And that was pretty scary. We were laughing when they accepted her because they were nervous about her pacemaker. They'd never had a kid with heart disease. We fell over when they said epilepsy. And at the home, they said, don't worry about it. Every second kid with autism develops epilepsy as a teenager. We can handle that. So they calmed us down immediately. And she was balanced for about a year, year and a half, and everything was fine. She had had a lot of seizures at school. She fell over a lot, but she never seriously got hurt, and everything was fine. And we were relaxed because they said that would be it. And then a couple of months before the end, she started having really massively big seizures, and she was clearly out of balance. So it takes time to get a kid back into balance. And while they were considering what medicine to give her and what to do, this just took her one morning, just pretty much like that, without warning. We didn't have a whole lot of time to relate to epilepsy. It was something, again, you know, we thought the end of the world was autism. And then this happened, and then they calm you down. And epilepsy, don't worry, is something you live with, and it's not a real problem. It's not like it used to be. But they were wrong, and we just didn't know.
Well, you know, there was controversy for a while about what, quote-unquote, caused autism. And now I think the professionals are pretty much all on the same page that it is a neurological disorder. And of course, epilepsy is too. So it wouldn't be surprising if children with true autism also developed the epilepsy, I guess.
That's so what they said.
So she might have been having some petit mal seizures even when she was much younger. But because she had that autism diagnosis, you all probably maybe just thought she was spacing out and didn't even realize that she was having a seizure. Isn't that true?
I don't know, because when she had that first seizure at 13, we really knew. We really knew, and it was shaking, and she just was not herself in any way that we had ever seen her before. And there's also a certain amount of pain with seizures, I think. At least there was a certain amount of screaming. She was visibly upset. As you said in the opening, it's really the only thing I think she ever hated because of the total loss of control of her body and everything that she knew. I tend to think that there was nothing until she was 13, and then we had that one seizure, and then it was quiet again for about a year before it started massively happening. I mean, you might be right. I've never seen it, and maybe I wouldn't have recognized it, but I don't really think so because this was so completely different. I don't see how we could have missed it.
Right. This sounds totally different. I actually have some friends who have children with epilepsy, and my nephew has had a problem with epilepsy too, and we didn't know what was going on with Nicholas at first. And they said that sometimes the doctor could tell just with the way he would blink his eyes that he was having maybe a little seizure. And it wasn't as apparent as what you're saying. What you're saying is readily apparent if there's pain involved or if all of a sudden there's a loss of consciousness. But with some of the other children I've known who have milder cases of epilepsy, it's just like they space out for a small period of time and then they're able to refocus. But for a little while, they're not able to focus, and that's when they're having these itty-bitty seizures. I think it's very complicated, Michael. Obviously, it must be complicated because if this institution that you're talking about was accustomed to dealing with children with autism and epilepsy, and yet Liel was taken like she was, they weren't prepared either.
I don't know if they could have been prepared anymore.
Right.
What they've learned from it now is they keep oxygen close by, but I don't think that would have mattered.
Right. Yeah, I don't think so either. I think sometimes when there's enough disruption in the brain, even if she were in a hospital, there wasn't really something that could be done. It's just that devastating.
I just think there are things that happen, and sometimes people just die. And that's a very hard thing to think about. It's a very hard thing to realize. But that's just what happened. And as difficult as that is, you have to sort of find a way to go on. If there's any comfort in this at all, I don't know. But I just think it happened, and there's nothing that anyone could have done to stop it. We don't hold the school responsible. We don't hold anybody else responsible. We don't have any questions for the doctors that weren't answered. It just happens. And right. As I said, 100 years ago, it just happened a lot more.
Right, and they didn't even know what caused it. A lot of times, the kids would just fall down.
Yeah.
They didn't know that the kid had cardiomegaly or had epilepsy. We didn't even know what was wrong. And a lot of times on autopsy, you can't tell if it's an electrical problem with the heart anyway. I don't know if they can with the brain, but I just think there are still a lot of unknowns. And you're right. We do have an maybe unreasonable expectation that our children are all supposed to be healthier than we are and they're supposed to live longer than we are. And that's not a given, even today. That's not a
good thing. I think the other thing is that not only do we expect them to live longer than us, but if they're in trouble, we expect ourselves to fix it. And therefore, there's a certain amount of guilt associated with what did we do wrong? We didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
We just didn't.
Right. I think that's a really healthy thing for you to say, Michael. And I think that's an important thing for parents to hear. Unfortunately, you and I know a lot more bereaved parents than anyone should have to know, because we were in the heart world for so many years. And unfortunately, a lot of the babies, especially 18 and 20 years ago, a lot of those babies didn't make it to adulthood. And I think you're right. I think, unfortunately, there is a lot of guilt that goes along with that, because we as parents feel that our major job is to protect our children. And the number one thing you want to protect your children from is dying, of course.
There are things you can't. The things you cannot do. You cannot do. I know, it's hard.
You're right. The last little question that I want to ask you, and it is a short question, is just what advice you would have for other Israeli parents who might have a child with epilepsy or who have a child who all of a sudden has been diagnosed with something unforeseen, the autism, the epilepsy. What advice can you give to those Israeli parents?
If you have multiple issues, like we had with the heart and everything else that came around that, make sure that all your doctors are on the same page. Make sure that all your doctors are talking to each other. Make sure you don't start some kind of therapy without checking with every other doctor down the line. One of the things that our hospital was not good at was getting all the doctors in one place at the same time on the same day. So if we had a cardiologist appointment, we weren't going to have it on the same day as we had a pacemaker appointment. That's unfortunate. There is another hospital, a children's hospital in Petah Tikva, which is near Tel Aviv, where one of their specialties, one of the things they're known for, is that when you come in, it's one-stop shopping. Your cardiology doctor is there. Your pacemaker doctor is there. If you have other issues, they're all there on the same day. So if you come from far away, it's all done. And that's the best advice, is make sure all the doctors are working together. They're all on the same page. And please, please, please find other families to talk to and share experiences, because you are not alone and they're not alone. And together you form a community, and there's more strength in the community.
Absolutely wonderful advice. That's wonderful. Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show today and for sharing your experiences and your advice with us.
Thank you very much. I've totally enjoyed this, and I'm not scared anymore.
Well, I'm glad you're not scared anymore. This was way overdue. This has been so much fun. So that does conclude this episode of Heart to Heart with Anna. Thanks for listening today. Please come back next week on Tuesday at noon Eastern Time for a brand new episode. But tune in tomorrow, because during the month of February, we will be having a radio show every single day. And please find and like us on Facebook. Check out our website, hearttoheartwithanna.com, and our Cafe Press Boutique. Follow our radio show on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. Please help us during the month of February by sharing information about this radio show with others and by following the radio show, especially on Spreaker. We're trying to get to 100 followers on Spreaker so we can petition iHeartRadio to carry the radio show. We know that congenital heart defects touch people all over the globe, but remember, my friends, you are not alone.
Thank you again for joining us this week. We hope you've been inspired and empowered to become an advocate for the congenital heart defect community. Heart to Heart with Anna, with your host Anna Jaworski, can be heard every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time. We'll talk again next week.